The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to the program. We're going to talk about REITs, real estate investment trusts, as they are less often referred to, with our guest, attorney Andy Campbell. Andy Campbell's practiced at the law firm of Morrison & Forster, or MOFO for short, as it is more often referred to, focuses on representing issuers and underwriters in capital market transactions and advising public and private companies on a variety of corporate and security matters. He has a particular focus, though, on the REIT industry. He regularly advises both issuers and underwriters in initial public offerings of REITs. And he is also one of the co-authors of the law firm's Guide to REIT IPOs. And Andy Campbell joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Andy, welcome to the program.
Mike, thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Appreciate you taking the time. So let's start with that REIT IPO guide. It may seem fairly obvious what the firm's motivation is there, but you tell me, why did the firm put out an IPO REIT IPO guide? And this is not your first guide, is that right? Is this one that's regularly updated? And tell us a little bit about the guide.
It is something that we've put out before, and we kind of tried to revamp it a little bit more this year. And the IPO Quick Guide is really meant to help companies considering the IPO path. It's a relatively short guide, and something that's sort of easily digestible, and something a business person can pick up and not be overwhelmed by and have too much detail. But we found the IPO process can certainly be daunting for a private company and its management team. For many of the executives we work with, it can be the first time that they've ever been through an IPO. And, others may have taken another company public, but it could have been 10 or 20 years ago. And many things about the IPO process has changed even in just the last 10 years. So for those who have never been through an IPO, our quick guide provides a nice overview of the process. And for others who have been through it but maybe don't live and breathe it like we do, it's a nice refresher. And as I mentioned, sort of by its name, we obviously don't intend for it to cover every detail or nuance of an IPO, but it provides a practical look at how to prepare for and carry out an IPO in a format and length that we think people will find helpful.
Now, you mentioned that a lot has changed even in the last 10 years, and we all know that the Dodd-Frank bill has had some impact there. A lot fewer companies are going public these days, so the expense of it, it's a very onerous process, as I'm sure you're painfully aware. So how have REITs of today and yesteryear changed, both in terms of what it takes to go public, say compared to 10 or 20 years ago, and also maybe the industry in general? How have REITs changed? Because it seems like there's a REIT for almost every niche real estate type these days. What about that? What about the going public? And one other thing, I'm sorry, I'm piling up a compound question on you, but the other part of this is, it seems that a lot of companies make the decision not to go public because it is such an onerous and expensive process, but it seems to make a lot of sense for REITs compared to some other players out there. What would you say about all three of those questions?
Well, as far as the process and the expense of it, I think, look, with going back to Sarbanes-Oxley and that sort of coming out in the early 2000s, it certainly did increase the costs of being a public company. And I think, the SEC over the past, 10 years has been focused on, ways to make it easier for smaller companies to go public, to lessen the burden. And one of the main things we saw out of that effort was the Jobs Act, which just limited some of the disclosure obligations, the financial statement requirements, executive compensation disclosure, and the auditor attestation requirement under 404B of Sarbanes-Oxley for a company's internal control over financial reporting. So there have been efforts to lower the cost and lower the burden of going public. But, you know, as you mentioned, it's still an expensive and a long process, and so something that companies don't undertake lightly. As far as, you know, REITs today and the REITs of yesteryear, I think, you know, one is just the size and the scope of the REIT industry. I think over the past 25 years, total equity market cap of listed U.S. REITs has grown from something like $9 billion to over $1 trillion. And today we have, you know, 31 REITs that are in the S&P 500. And they're just much more, you know, mainstream for institutional investors than maybe they were 20 or 30 years ago. One example of that is just the creation of the GIX real estate sector in 2016, which, you know, previously REITs were grouped together in the financial sector. And then what you mentioned, I think, is what I would say is one of the biggest differences, just the there's so many different types of REITs today than there were in the early days of the industry, you know, where the focus was really, you know, office, retail, healthcare, apartments, lodging, and other commercial properties. I think listed REITs today are now in 12 or more sectors. They've expanded, you know, into self-storage, data centers, farmland, timber, student housing, manufactured housing, single-family homes, cell phone towers, casinos, prisons, and, you know, billboards. So some of those have been around for quite a while now, but others have just, you know, come about in the last 5 or 10 years.
Now, REITs are endlessly inventive, is what the guide says. I'm taking that phrase right from your guide, endlessly inventive. Give us some examples of that inventiveness. And by the way, I stand corrected. I had mentioned Dodd-Frank. It's Sarbanes-Oxley was the legislation I was trying to think of. So thank you for the correction on that. But endlessly inventive, what are some of the examples of the inventiveness of REITs these days?
Well, I think one of the primary examples is, you know, the different asset classes that REITs now focus on, as I mentioned. I think that shows the creativity of REIT management teams that seek out alternative sectors that can utilize the REIT model. But I think another example is just how REITs adapt their properties based on consumer and market trends. You know, you have industrial or logistics REITs that have adapted and capitalized on the e-commerce trends and meeting last-mile delivery needs. How multifamily and student housing REITs have adapted their properties to meet the needs and desires of younger generations, whether it's more efficiency apartments or just the technology and Wi-Fi connectivity that tenants demand, and how mall and other retail REITs have and are adapting their properties and leasing strategies to the significant changes in the retail industry.
Now, I've heard that there are even, what, gas station REITs and movie theater REITs? Do they still exist?
There are in some forms. Certainly entertainment REITs that are out there.
So some of the statistics you've got from the research you guys have done in the past and right up to the present says that there were 9 re-IPOs. This is 2017. 9 re-IPOs raised about $2.9 billion. In 2018, there were 5 re-IPOs, about half the number, but they raised $3.3 billion in gross proceeds. So half the number, but greater proceeds. Is the drop in the number of IPOs but the surge in proceeds, is there anything to that, or is it just happenstance that those numbers shifted that way?
Well, you know, in 2017, I think the majority of that $2.9 billion came from one IPO, which was Invitation Homes. It's a Blackstone-backed single-family housing REIT, which raised about $1.8 billion. The other REITs were smaller deals that are, you know, $250 million or less, and several that were actually less than $100 million. So you saw smaller, more IPOs in 17, but for the most part were smaller deals other than the one. And then in 2018, we actually got to a really promising start with, I think, 3 IPOs in January, but it ended up being a tough year with none getting done in the second half of 2018. Those that were able to get out were just ended up being larger deals that ranged from like $500 million to, you know, $1.4, $1.5 billion. And I think, you know, as far as no IPOs getting done in the second half of 18, and really, you know, as I'll mention, just one in 2019 so far, you know, one of the factors contributing to that is just there's been a disconnect, you know, over the past year or so between public and private market valuations. There's a lot of capital in the private markets, and sponsors in the real estate space have a pretty good sense of where their properties will trade. Then you look at the public markets, and you have REITs, at least in some asset classes, that have traded at, you know, sometimes significant discounts to their net asset values or NAV. And when you factor in that discount plus an IPO discount, all of a sudden the pricing for an IPO doesn't look very favorable compared to what you can get in the private market. So that's one reason you've seen more M&A activity in the REIT space over the past 12 months than you have in the IPO market. I think, you know, for the deals that we've seen get done, they're generally either larger deals for companies with really significant size and scale that can compete with their public peers from a cost of capital basis, or, you know, smaller deals for companies with a differentiating story or asset class. I think without one of those factors, you actually see many of the REIT-dedicated investors choose to sit on the sidelines for the IPO and maybe wait to see how it trades, and then if they're interested, you know, waiting to invest until the company does a follow-on offering.
So who does go public? Historically, are these non-traded REITs or non-listed REITs that have reached a certain scale and decided we're ready to go public, or are these companies or organizations that have very large real estate holdings and decide to go IPO? Is there, when an IPO occurs with a REIT, where does it come from? Who does go public, even though the numbers are fairly small? Most recently, say in the last 12 months, it sounds like just one, but who does go public in the REIT world?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned those in the public non-listed space that are sort of, if they have a term and they're nearing the end of that cycle and need to execute a liquidity event, that's certainly an option for an IPO. Others are, you know, people in the real estate industry who've, you know, gathered a portfolio that they've accumulated over the years, and they maybe want to roll that up and actually, you know, get some liquidity for their investors. Then sometimes even have just companies that have, or a management team that maybe has experience in the industry and is looking to do what we'd call a blind pool IPO, which is just a strategy they have and they're looking to go out and raise money and are basically, you know, executing that IPO more off of their track record and the opportunities they see in a particular sector. That's something we saw a lot of right after the downturn in 2008 and 2009, where there were a lot of distressed assets and companies that, you know, private equity sponsors that had externally managed REITs that were, you know, doing blind pool offerings for that purpose.
Let's talk about who is suited to go public as a REIT. Let's say some guy walks in your office, says, I want to do a REIT IPO. What are some of the antecedents or the groundwork that you want to see has been done, or the situation you want to see that you would say you're ready to do this and can be successful at it?
You know, I think as when you look at the type of company, I think you know, one category is a company that I mentioned maybe has a size and scale and will be able to compete with their public peers in terms of cost of capital. Another category, as I mentioned, would be the smaller companies that have a differentiating story, strategy, or asset class that can offer more significant growth prospects than investors can get with a large, maybe existing REIT. And I think, you know, regardless of the company, you're looking for a strong management team that, you know, hopefully has a proven track record. You want to see a strong balance sheet with prudent leverage and sufficient growth capital coming out of the gate. And that leverage and growth capital really gets the right sizing on IPO. And because the last thing you want is, company to go public and to be, you know, over-levered, not have access to growth capital, and then not be able to execute on its strategy, so that it really gets stuck in a box. And if you don't have capital to execute on your business plan or growth strategies, then there's downward pressure on the stock because investors know they're going to have to get back in the market and raise additional capital. So the company's really forced to either sit still and, you know, not grow, or issue equity at dilutive prices. What you want in a good, in a well-executed IPO is have the company come out of the gate with a strong balance sheet and sufficient growth capital so the management can execute and grow the business, and then when they're ready to do a follow-on offering, they're doing that from a position of strength. So as to the antecedents of a successful IPO, beyond the company itself, the management team, and a well-developed strategy and story, I think it's critical for a company to have experienced and sophisticated advisors. As we talked about, you know, the IPO process can be complicated and lengthy, and oftentimes we're dealing with executives who haven't been through the process before. And so good advisors can really help a company plan properly and simplify the process, help them plan ahead and focus on the right issues and tasks at the right time, so the company's ready to launch its IPO when the market conditions are favorable. As anybody who's been through the process knows, timing is critical and market windows, you know, open and shut quickly. So you need to be ready, and the right advisors can help a company ensure it's not caught flat-footed when the right market opportunity presents itself.
Well, we are all expecting that the real estate industry is going to have its eventual downturn. Now, let's say that somebody is sitting on the sidelines right now, has torn a page out of Sam Zell's book, has a vulture fund waiting, and then moves into the market and scoops up properties at a discount when the market takes its downturn, and walks in the door and says, "Hey, this, I want to create an IPO. These properties are going to take the ride back up as soon as the market improves, the economy improves." Is that a strategy that you think holds any water?
I think it could. I mean, obviously, it depends on the market actually having that downturn and, you know, buying at the right prices and then, you know, timing the upswing properly. But it's a strategy, you know, as I mentioned with the blind pool REITs in 08 and 09, it's not dissimilar to what some of those companies did and what others did, you know, in the private sector, and then, you know, going public in 2012 and 2013, when actually in 2013 we saw a lot more IPOs than we're seeing today.
Interesting. So including the United States, and check me on these stats, I believe that there are 36 countries that now have REIT legislation, including places like Mexico and India, with others that are considering REITs. What do you think that says about the REIT industry or REIT structure? And how different, I don't know how familiar you are with some of these other countries and their legislation, but how different is the REIT structure, say, in Mexico or India vis-a-vis the United States?
You know, Mike, I don't know the details of the structures in those other countries. I know my colleagues at MOFO have a really outstanding J-REIT practice in Asia, but I think the additional legislation and seeing that many countries adopting REIT legislation is just a testament to the success of the REIT structure and how, you know, REIT legislation has encouraged investment in real estate and provided investors with an opportunity to own interest in a diversified, you know, portfolio of real estate that they otherwise would not have the opportunity to do.
So it does sound like MOFO is involved in some of the overseas REIT players. If you look around the globe, and again, I don't know whether you can answer this question or not, but how are some of these other industries faring in places, again, like Mexico or India, and I believe China is getting ready to move into create some REIT structure. How do you see them faring overseas? Do you have any sense of that?
You know, my practice is focused on U.S. REITs. You know, I mentioned as a firm, we have one of the top corporate and capital markets practices in Asia, and are generally, you know, considered one of the top firms when it comes to J-REIT offerings. And so I think just in that market, you know, my colleagues tell me it's, you know, continues to be primarily more straightforward asset classes, not really the niche asset classes that we're seeing in the U.S. and some of the expansion. And I think as far as the market, cap rates have been declining in recent years, and it's made a challenge for a lot of J-REITs to aggressively acquire new properties, especially in office and residential sectors. But as a result, you see J-REITs with, strong sponsor-supported pipelines, having better success doing global offerings, whereas many other J-REITs have had to turn their focus to, internal growth and expansion through M&A.
So some of the REIT sectors that have done extremely well are industrial and self-storage, although I think self-storage has finally softened some. I believe I've seen some statistics on that just recently. And one of the big accounting consulting firms came out with a report saying that industrial is probably going to start to slow considerably over the next few years. Do you involve yourself at all, pay attention to the different property types and how they're performing? Do you have any forecasts? I don't know if you're in the forecasting business, Andy, but do you have any forecasts as to how you see the REIT industry in general performing over, say, the next 3 to 5 years? And are there any property types that you would point to that you see looking particularly robust or kind of poised to make a rush?
Certainly, it's not my. I don't make money by making projections or forecasts. There's certainly people more qualified to do that, but I do pay attention to it, and we like to have our have a good sense of what asset classes and what sectors are performing the best. As you mentioned, industrial has just been on a tear over the past several years, and I think that's obviously can't continue forever. And as you mentioned, self-storage, obviously has performed exceptionally well and, is having some of the oversupply and new developments is actually putting some pressure on their performance. But, I think REITs are still well positioned as a whole to perform well. We are at the tail end of a very positive and strong real estate market. But REITs today, compared to 2007 and 2008, are much, much better positioned to weather a downturn in the economy than they were then. The leverage is significantly down across the industry compared to where it was in 2007 or 2008. So you have REITs that are much more, much better prepared, have stronger balance sheets to actually weather any sort of downturn.
Interesting. Well, I'm sure some investors will take heart in that for sure. So our guest has been Andy Campbell. He is an attorney with the law firm of Morrison and Forster, and he specializes in the REIT industry and taking REITs public. Andy, thank you for taking the time.
Mike, I really appreciate it. Thank you for taking the time.